Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Could you please lower the volume? Tim's dad called across the room. No response. This din is giving me a headache. Oh, 14-year-old Tim looked up from the computer screen. Sorry. He pulled off one of his earpieces. I didn't hear you. I was concentrating. Tim's dad came over and stood behind Tim's chair. Concentrating? On what? Right here, Tim pointed to an open book on the table. We've got a Spanish quiz tomorrow, and I'm checking out the stuff we're supposed to know. Well, then, Tim's dad's eyes widened. What is going on the computer? Oh, Tim leaned forward, becoming re-engaged with the screen. I'm just IMing with Kelly. We might go to a brother's game on Saturday if we can get a ride. How can you concentrate on instant messaging with Kelly and do your homework? Tim's dad scratched his head. No big deal, Tim grunted, readjusting his headphones. Got a new CD on the iPod so I can chill while I'm working. Your feet aren't busy, Tim's dad grunted under his breath. Maybe you could crush grapes for wine while you're at it. From a parent's perspective, what should we know about multitasking for kids? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has been working with brain research for a number of years. Dr. Jordan Grafman is chief of the Cognitive Neuroscience Section at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke at the National Institutes of Health. He's an elected fellow of the American Psychological Association and has received both the Defense Meritorious Service Award and the National Institutes of Health Award of Merit. Dr. Grafman's section is attempting to identify the nature of representational knowledge stored in the human prefrontal cortex, the cognitive properties of representational binding that form episodes in our memories, and the types of cognitive neuroplasticity that occur during learning and recovery from brain damage. Dr. Grafman is also the father of two very young sons. Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So we want to talk today about multitasking, and we want to know what it actually means.
Multitasking means you're doing more than one thing, and then usually people add at a time. But the time can sort of vary. So let's say you're doing two things over an hour. Is that multitasking, or does it mean one hand is reaching for an object, your eyes are watching something on the computer screen all at the same time? I think that's the modern version of multitasking, and that's sort of the arena we're talking about, is when you're doing a lot of things at once in a short period of time.
Don't we all do more than one thing at a time these days, sort of necessity?
We do more things, perhaps, during the day than we used to, maybe 50 years, or even 100, certainly 100 years ago. So that's true. But now we have technology that can certainly allow us to double up, triple up, quadruple up what we're doing at any one time. So I think technology plays a large role in this notion of multitasking.
Although it's funny, when I hear your description of multitasking, I think, well, every parent does that all the time. You're grabbing the kid, you're turning off the stove, you're answering the phone, you're reading the mail. You're doing this all the time.
You are doing it all the time if you want to do it all the time, or if you feel you need to do it all the time. But you don't have to do it all the time. And that depends how you arrange your day and what you believe is important in your day. And that is clearly a determiner of how much multitasking you do.
Except I would think when you have young kids, and you can speak with some authority on this, you have to multitask all the time you're awake. Because if you have to pay attention to a child, if you only do that, you can't do some very basic things in your life.
Well, that's true. But sometimes those kinds of things occur over longer periods of time, whether it's, say, you're playing with your child and you have to go cook dinner. That brings us to sort of an issue involved in multitasking. That is, do we really do things at the same time? Or do we wind up ordering things? So we do the A first, then B, then C, then back to A, then to C, then back to B. And in fact, it turns out that's how we do most of our multitasking.
That's how the brain works.
That's how the brain works, and that's how our behavior works. So in fact, what we're really doing when we multitask is we're taking however many things we want to be doing, and we're ordering them. And how much time we spend on each single task while we're doing, say, one, two, three, or four tasks is partly determined by our decision-making and partly determined by demands of the technology or the other people we're with. It's sort of a partnership between what you want to do and what the world demands of you. The culture sort of tells us how much we should do, what's appropriate, and then we have to determine, is that correct for us?
What is the difference in the brain between an adult's multitasking and a child's multitasking like we had in the story?
I think that's really a key issue, because I have all the technology, I'm sure, in my office or even at home that any teenager has. I'm sure I do. You know, I'm able to do anything I've read about that a teenager tries to accomplish. But I decide what's important. I decide, too, how to deliberate. If I need to think about something more deeply, I'm not going to answer an instant message. I'm not going to answer my email right away. I might even turn off the music I'm listening to because I need to think more deeply about a topic. Now, that comes from years of experience, from living, actually, long enough that my prefrontal cortex has developed and matured. A teenager or even a younger child does not have a mature prefrontal cortex, and therefore, to some degree, they're more susceptible to keys from the environment, to clues, to stimuli, to noise, to visual stimuli. They are going to be more distractible than an adult. I think we're all talking about computer use and sitting in a room and having headphones on and using that kind of technology. Then those kids are going to be more susceptible to pop-up items on the computer than I would be.
So does that mean that we are vindicated, those of us who told our kids starting in middle school that they could not do their homework with music on? Say yes. Oh, say yes.
I'm not going to say yes.
My children should not be listening.
I'm not going to say yes because it actually depends on what you're doing. Let's say, for example, I have an assignment where I basically need to copy something down. I'm looking at something and I'm writing it down, and I'm listening to music at the same time. I can probably do both of those things more or less at the same time because copying does not require a great deal of thinking, reasoning, or deliberation. But if my homework assignment involves me to think more deeply about something, and I have to do it on my own, I'm not going to look up how someone else thought more deeply about it, but I need the exercise to do it. I need to reason it out. Then I better be careful about what music I have in the background and how loud it is, because that is going to be distracting enough that it may keep me from reasoning or thinking deeply about something. Now, there is an exception to this occasionally, that if you're not listening to lyrics, some people might argue that music, in fact, can facilitate that reasoning process to some degree if it's a little bit in the background. But everything I'm talking about requires me to be the decision maker about it, for me to have judgment about what's quality and what isn't, what's deliberation and what isn't, what it requires to think more deeply and what doesn't. And if I don't have the skills to do that, I may make poor decisions. So the issue is a little bit about how much you do at one time or what you choose to do at one time. But the greater issue is not the technology and the capability. The greater issue is how do you decide what to do and when to do it?
Which means it sounds like that children need to have adults help make those decisions.
I think for sure they do. They model adults. And if you're not there to help them make the decisions and they have to do it on their own, they're going to be seduced by the technology.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on multitasking kids.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Jordan Grafman about kids who multitask. Here's something that's going to get everybody very distressed, but I think you need to probably say this. When does the prefrontal cortex actually mature?
From the latest research, most people would say now mid-20s.
Okay, so everybody out there who's getting their kid to do college applications and tries to have any high school stuff be in any kind of order, we have to understand that that's not working so well in the brain right now.
It's not going to be so easy. But you bring up something in a way that I think is also important here as a parent. If you say to your child, listen, take off that headphone. If you're reading a story and you have to interpret the deeper meaning of it, take off the headphone, shut down the computer, just read the story. But then if you're running around, the kid's going to look at you and say, wait a minute, that's what you're doing. You know, you're driving us around to 15 things. You're talking on the cell phone in the car. You're the one that's doing this. Why should I be different from you? So you have to provide, as a parent, some modeling that says, at least sometimes, under certain conditions, you have to do what I say, and maybe not as I do.
My sons were growing up before this technology. When they played music while they were studying, I heard it. They had stereos and boomboxes and things in their rooms, and I heard the music, and I could tell if it was really loud. I am a person who could never do two things at one time when I was studying, and so I never would have had music on. I used to go up and say, how can you concentrate on your homework with the music playing? I can't do it unless there's music in the background. Mm-hmm. So my thought there would be, if you ask them to take the headphones off and go ahead and read, will that interrupt their concentration abilities, because they've trained themselves that way?
I grew up in Chicago, and I used to live near the elevated track, and we got used to the trains coming on a regular schedule. When they didn't show up on time, it was quite disturbing. And I think you're saying, I'm not equating music with the L coming by the apartment, but there would be an aspect to that, certainly initially. Mm-hmm. And if it's simply just listening to music and reading or doing one other thing, you could possibly argue, well, is that any different from walking and talking? As long as one of the tasks is very automatic, that you don't have to pay a lot of attention to, and the other task that you're focusing on, then it's possible to do that kind of activity, I think, with some practice, especially if you enjoy music. It's not too loud and doesn't dominate or interfere with your thought processes. Probably that's okay. Let me give you an example to highlight what I think one problem is. If you're, say, studying a passage from a book and you have to do a report on it for class, and you're getting verbal messages that require some social activity or at least some social knowledge, and now you have to think about the complexity of the social interactions, and isn't that important when you're growing up and you're a kid and a teenager? I mean, that is as important as what you're learning academically in school. And it really is, actually. It's important to learn social skills and social behavior. And we don't get taught that very easily. Sometimes the parents teach it, but more often than not, it's let's see if this works, you know, in high school, for sure. So they're practicing that as well. Well, that's verbal. You have to think about that in language. How can you concentrate on the passage, which is verbal? And you have to reason verbally. You have to think, is there an analogy to this? Is this a metaphor for something? And you're still thinking about, gee, should I ask her out? Where's she going to be tomorrow? How can you mold the two together and do equally well in both? Well, that's sort of a segue into what's the research tell us? Because we haven't gotten to that yet. And I think we ought to hear about the research. Mm-hmm. And what the research says is when you have to divide your attention among competing tasks, your performance declines. That is the bottom line. What it means is, as well as you might do in performing each task independently, you will decline on one or the other or both when you have to do them together. Performance decline can mean you'll make more errors, depending on the task, or you'll do the task more slowly. That is consistent across many studies, across many years. So we know that you won't do as well. And that is usually based just on simple detection. I see something or I don't, or I hear something or I don't, or I have to press a button at a certain time. Imagine if you have to think more deeply about something. Your errors are going to increase, and you'll think in a more shallow fashion. You won't think as deeply. And for most things we do in life, to do them well, you have to deliberate and think about them and reason out the problem. You may not have to do it each time you're faced with the problem, but you'll certainly have to do it the first time and perhaps many times afterwards you're first faced with a task. So that's important. Now, maybe somebody who's listening, you know, who's 12 or 13, saying, oh, man, that's for old folks, you know. I mean, we're young. We were brought up in this. It turns out that almost all the studies are done with freshmen in college. It may be more difficult for older people in some respects. That's true. On the other hand, older people are wiser decision makers based on experience, so they can decide when to do what. And that enables them maybe to accomplish a little bit more over a longer time period than somebody who's younger and having a lot of interfering tasks and not able to make wiser decisions about what's important at what point in time.
I'm hearing this and I'm thinking to myself in great panic about young drivers and cell phones.
I have almost nothing good to say about using your cell phone when driving, and that's based on my personal experience in driving, and it's also based, fortunately, on a lot of studies. The research shows people drive more slowly and more erratically when they're using cell phones in the car. And more slowly means not just imperceptibly more slowly, but recognizably more slowly. And I challenge the listener, next time they're on the road and they see somebody in front of them who's driving what seems to them excessively slow, either the person's looking for an address and they don't know where they are, of course, that's an explanation. But I bet more often than not, they're going to be dialing a cell phone, looking for the cell phone, or talking on the cell phone. Does that increase the likelihood of accidents? It certainly does when people are listening to cell phones and doing driving simulators. And there's some evidence this also increases the likelihood of an accident when you're driving on the road or infractions of driving, for example, centerline crossings. If you have to use your cell phone, you should do it before you're in the car, after you get out of the car, or pull over. That's the general advice you would give. And I know some people say, well, it's impossible to do that. You know, what if I'm lost? It's always possible to do that. It's the rare exception that you can't do that. But that's a decision maker. Now we're back to when you make a decision about how to use a cell phone.
Are you including the hands-free devices that are sometimes the legal way to do it in some parts of
the country? The risk is not from whether you're holding the phone or not. Mm-hmm. The risk is from dividing your attention.
Mm-hmm. Are there longer-range consequences, developmentally or physiologically, to multitasking that we might not be aware of?
There is no good answer yet, because a lot of the problems we're talking about have to do with recently introduced technology, and I mean recently, within the last 15 or 20 years. We don't know of any long-term effects because we'd have to go way out in time and then compare it to people who were raised before the advent of some of this technology. And, of course, some of us hope we live long enough to be that comparison group, but certainly that's a key issue. Now, I don't think there's necessarily going to be any adverse effects from a biological or medical point of view. Do people change in the way they learn? Do people learn differently? And will that cost them in some way on a job? Or what about our competition with other countries? Here comes my speculation. I absolutely think it's a potential danger for the inventiveness of people who use this technology all the time. If you can't think in a deliberative way, if you're not willing to say, I need the time to think about some issue and not worried about trying to do two or three things at the same time, then we will lose, no doubt, on average, our ability to be inventive and therefore to compete against other countries. Now, you could say this is a worldwide phenomenon, and you'd be right. You may go into a poor village in Africa and somebody may have a cell phone, but not a bathroom inside the house. So it is absolutely true that people use technology when it's available, and this could become a worldwide effort. But if other countries are more concerned about enforcing deliberative thinking, which I would say our country tends not to do by and large, then they are going to have a competitive advantage over us. Multitasking in the way we're talking about it steers people away from deliberative thinking, and that will cost us.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on multitasking kids.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Jordan Grafman about kids multitasking.
So it sounds like the child whose parents insist that he have some time just to go outside and play or to sit in a tree and think or to read a book or some quiet time in his day is a child who has a real advantage.
In the long run, I think so. In the short run, you have to persuade them that they're not going to lose out because the technology is sexy. I mean, there's nothing like, seriously, if you can get on the web and you can have a number of pages up there and you're instant messaging, if you're video conferencing or video messaging, why do you have to type in if you have a camera? There's going to be much more sophisticated technology coming that's going to be generally available. And you're thinking, of course, multitasking in a studio at home. No, the future is going to be, you and I are wearing glasses, Linda. And I can tell you this is going to be built in to packs that will have satellite communication. We'll have cameras in our glasses. I'll give you an example of this. The implications are important, I think, if we're doing it at home now. What's the future going to be like? Well, if we accept this form of thinking and we can mount a little video camera in our glasses, I can turn it on, and as I walk down the street, I'm going to say, boy, I'd sure like to know if I ever saw these people before. And there will be face recognition software. And they may go to a general database that says, this is your name or something like that. The potential is there. Or in your own database. That is, if I know you and I've met you once, maybe I take a picture of you. So you're going to be able to do that while you're even walking down the street. In other words, you will be in a position to have no escape from potential multitasking. So I think to think about how to teach children and adults what's appropriate at the right time is as big an issue as learning how to use the we should all use the technology. The technology is there for us. The most important thing is to know when to use it.
This is way beyond my husband's Dick Tracy wristwatch idea. Oh, are there any kinds of situations where it would be advantageous for kids to multitask in terms of what our values are, not what their values are?
Sure. I'm not sure it'd be so important for a young child, but say you potentially were going to work at a job that required you to focus on a number of things at the same time. So, for example, if I was an air traffic controller, I ought to have some skills in multitasking, but I better have the knowledge to know when to lay off and when to focus. When air traffic controllers ran into a problem with a plane, for example, they didn't just stare at the screen with a lot of planes flying around. They actually got help. That's called situated cognition, where other workers will come in and give opinions about the same case, and then you come to a group decision about what to do. But that's a rare job where that demand is very important. In most situations, you really don't have to do the kind of simultaneous activity, one, two, three, four things at the same time. I'll give you an example. As you mentioned, I work at the National Institutes of Health. A lot of people carry BlackBerries around, foam BlackBerries. You know, they're very sophisticated, and they will buzz every time somebody gets an email if it's turned on. Now, I'm sitting at a meeting with two or three people, and everybody's grabbing for their pants. You wonder what's going on. It's BlackBerry's going off. And you're at a meeting with two or three people, and they're not even looking at you. They're looking at their BlackBerry. And you say, well, what do you think about that? And they go, huh? What? What? They haven't paid attention. There's a real-life example. So you make these kinds of educated, intelligent decisions about what to do when, and that enables us to succeed better. Now, is there another risk besides performance? A lot of people talk about the brain like it's a finished product. The brain is not a finished product. Even in development, the brain is a little bit adaptive. So if you wind up doing one thing better and more, you're going to probably do another thing a little bit less well. Although in the normal scheme of things, nobody's going to notice too much the difference. But what happens if generation after generation, we multitask more, as we're getting used to, and deliberate less? It's quite possible those areas of the brain that we consider important as humans might change over many generations to accommodate what we do more rather than what we do less. It's a natural thing. If all of a sudden the earth was flooded and we were like Noah in an ark and all there was water, I'm sure we'd develop skills and the appropriate brain areas to enable us to swim better, to do all sorts of things that you're required to do when you're at sea. Well, if we deliberate less and we love the technology more, it's very clear some brain areas concerned with using visual motor skills are probably going to increase. Our ability to divide our attention in space might get better. But our ability to think, deliberate, plan, achieve long-term goals will probably decline. There's nothing magic about that. You can look at the history of evolution. And you see animals adapt all the time. So we're really the captain steering our brain. What we're going to determine in the future is as important as understanding our past. And I think when people discuss evolution, they're almost always discussing the past. But in fact, they ought to also think about where we're going. We're one of the few species, by thinking, that can determine evolutionary change rather than just by responding to environmental contingencies.
What resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues we've been discussing?
Time magazine and some of the other news magazines over the last 2 or 3 years have produced issues related to this. And that's a first good place to go to learn about multitasking. If you have access to a computer, and I imagine almost everybody will, then the Kaiser Family Foundation produced a video based on a meeting that discussed this issue. So just by going on the web, if you go to the Kaiser Family Foundation, you ought to be able to eventually link to the specific issues. Now, beyond that, there are no great popular books on multitasking that you can pick up and read, but there's a huge scientific literature. So anybody who wants to read a little bit more about the science, and some of it is actually readable by anybody who takes the time to want to do it, that's deliberate, then what they can do is to go to PubMed, which is a free scientific search engine. You put in multitasking as a single word, and it will pop up all the articles with their abstracts, and you can take a little time and read a little bit about it, and you'll see the scientific evidence, and there's a lot of it.
Okay. Well, you have given us an awful lot of scientific evidence and a lot of good, solid common sense. So, Dr. Jordan Grafman, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was fun. Thanks for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address, and please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to, and mention show number 337.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice on a podcast. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.